night, when the moon is high, the shadows dance, evil will rise. The world between the living and the dead is thin. So now is the time to let the horror you know end.
Welcome back to the Horror You Know podcast. This is Trent.
Oh, I'm Ian.
I am also Ian.
That was a great intro, guys. I was expecting it to go off the rails, and we nailed it, I gotta say. It's probably because Means isn't here.
Wow.
That's what it is. He fucks up our cheese.
He always screws us up.
Means, I miss you.
He's not even joking. That's the only reason he shows up at these things, is to see Means.
That's true. Trent, what are you talking for? Is it Wells hosting tonight?
I'll hand him my notes if he wants to. They're very thorough.
I could probably read them better than you.
Than me?
So, sadly... Probably. This entire time that we've been talking off air, I've been thinking, I've even been gesturing toward Wells about his episode tonight. He's not doing an episode tonight. That's right. Trent.
Well, we were going to do two episodes tonight.
But they were never involving Wells.
But Wells didn't do his homework for the first time in the history of the podcast,
I think.
We established
it was a little miscommunication.
A little miscommunication. That's all right. You guys will never know because the episodes will still come out when they're supposed to, and you'll be none the wiser. Just a little sneak peek behind the curtain of how the magic
happens. We are still going to do that episode, though. It's not lost in the wind.
Yeah, we won't give it away yet, but stay tuned for it. It'd be a good one, I'm sure. Before we get started, though, I think Wells wanted to give a special message.
That's right. This message here is for all the special ladies out there in our lives and all of you special ladies listening around the world from the Horror You Know podcast. Happy International Women's Day.
Happy. Wait, is it actually today or is it going to be the day that this episode airs?
No. Well, it's actually today, so okay. You'll be
happy belated.
Happy belated.
Yeah, by the time you hear this, you'll be removed from that day, but every day is
Women's Day. You'll be removed from that day.
Yeah.
So today's what, March 8th?
Yeah.
And this episode will come out, we don't know, but...
It'll be out.
Hopefully all the women are still thriving out there, even though it's no longer Women's Day. You got your one day, okay?
That's right.
Back to normal.
Hey, every day is Women's Day.
That's right.
Damn right.
And what better way to celebrate than a story about home invasion and murder?
I like to celebrate myself with two claps and a Ric Flair.
Woo!
Please.
Nothing from you, Ian?
Okay. Wow. From a couple of big football fans, they didn't even get that.
The Ric Flair?
Yeah. They do that in the football locker rooms in the NFL.
Oh. I thought you were just doing Ric Flair.
No.
Oh,
it's okay. Two claps and a Ric Flair.
Speaking of home invasion and murders, we'll try not to murder this episode any more than it already is. We're talking about a little movie from 2008 called The Strangers.
Dun, dun, dun.
You all seen
stranger,
it? You've all know it?
Stranger, what are you buying, Stranger?
No, not the Stranger from Resident Evil 4.
Would that be all for you, Stranger?
The Merchant.
Oh, no. This is different.
One day, though, maybe.
But Trent, I have my black cloak.
Well, what are you selling?
What are you buying?
Speaking of Strangers, though, they are making a new trilogy based on The Strangers. You all know that?
Yeah, the new one comes out in the next
very
month.
Soon.
I haven't seen, was it The Strangers Pray at Night?
I haven't watched that one.
I haven't either.
Are you familiar with who's in the new one?
I actually looked it up earlier, and no, I didn't recognize anybody.
So the main girl in it, she is in the show Riverdale.
Oh, that's probably why I didn't know.
So is it like, what should I say, a reboot of the series or a continuation?
What would you call that?
I don't know much about it other than it takes place at an Airbnb this time. So I don't think it's the same location, but it looks like the same, like it looks like the people are wearing the same masks maybe as the originals, just based on the picture I saw. So, but I know it's a planned trilogy because it's called Chapter 1.
And, okay. So it could be about some copycats just in another area.
Could be. But again, we've not even seen the sequel, Pray at Night, so we can't speak to that either if that was a continuation.
We haven't prayed at night.
Is that the only sequel there was?
So far, yes.
Okay.
But that's okay because we're not talking about that one. We're talking about the original. Hopefully everyone has seen the original. It's a classic.
I might watch that this weekend, though. They're both on Shudder, by the way, if y'all have that.
I have heard that Pray at Night is actually decent. take that for what you will.
Nice.
A lot of horror sequels usually aren't, but if anyone out there has seen it, weigh in. But again, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the original. And the original, as it says on the front, is inspired by true events. What events, you ask? Well, we're here to tell you. So there's actually three different stories that kind of inspired this movie. The movie itself is not an actual retelling of something that happened. It was just loosely inspired by some things. So we're going to go over them. The first of the three, do you guys want to take a guess what this could be? It's a very, very famous home
invasion.
The town
that dreaded sundown? I skipped way ahead. I was just waiting to say that. So I believe there's a
real true crime that inspired this movie. Think Manson home invasions. Thank you, Ian. Ian's all over it. The Charles Manson murders.
They probably also dreaded sundown.
No, I was just thinking. I was like,
the murders happened after
sundown. Huh? I was just thinking. I was like, I think now that you said that, I think I've actually heard that before.
But the China dreaded sundown inspired this movie?
No, about the Charles Manson connection.
Oh, well, obviously that it's a very famous case and it inspired a lot of different movies, which is part of the reason why I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail about it. I feel like a lot of people are fairly familiar with the Manson murders. Yes? No? Yes?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I'm not going to go into a whole lot of, because I feel like we could probably devote like a whole ass episode to the Manson murders one day. So I'm kind of saving some of that.
We could dedicate a whole ass to this.
I could dedicate a whole ass to you if anytime.
If it's mine, then you're not going to.
I feel like Means maybe was the one that said it. And Means, I apologize if I'm wrong, but I feel like Means said there was like some kind of loose connection between Friday the 13th.
Oh my God. Hold on. Back up. We got to cut that
that's
out.
That's usually.
Start your sentence over.
Trent doing that.
I feel like it was Means. Means, I apologize if you didn't actually say this, but I feel like it was Means who told me there was like a loose connection between Friday the 13th and the town that dreaded sundown and the strangers.
Because they all have sack-headed killers, maybe?
Maybe.
Sack-headed killers.
Well, that's true. I think
all inspired from the same thing.
Which one was first? I think sundown was first, and then, Friday the 13th 2, where Jason wears the sack, I think they did pretty much rip that off from that.
And then
movie.
Sackboy from PlayStation.
Sackboy, yeah.
Right.
So anyway, we'll just kind of go over loosely
the
Manson murders. The Manson family, obviously a cult active in Southern California in the late 60s and early 70s, formed by Charles Manson. At its peak, the group consisted of around 100 followers. Various members of the Manson family were responsible for a series of murders. The group was confirmed to have killed 9 people, though it's believed that they could have potentially killed up to 24 people. And the most famous one of these murders, which was one of the inspirations for this movie, The Strangers, was... Ian?
The Manson murders. There's another one.
The victim. Who is the famous murder of the
murders? Sharon Tate.
Yes, Sharon Tate. Are you familiar with her?
I almost said Sharon Stone.
She was a famous actress at the time. She was married to Roman Polanski. You know who that is? He's a director. I don't know if you've maybe heard that name.
No,
before.
I've heard both of these names, though, just from like watching documentaries and stuff on Charles Manson. I'm just not real familiar with the people.
Have you seen the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Quentin Tarantino? He kind of does his take on.
If you haven't, you can skip it.
I don't think I have seen that one. Biggest fan of it either.
I
like Tarantino a lot. I'm not going to get into a Tarantino debate. Everyone was hyping that movie up. It was fine.
I think Tarantino's overrated.
See, I like him usually, but I just thought that one was just okay. I don't know. Maybe I need to watch it again. But anyway.
He made quite a bit of classics, though.
He does his take on the Sharon Tate murders and Charles Manson murders. It's more about, it's not about that, but that's a small part of the movie. But anyway, Sharon Tate was a real-life famous actress from back in that time. And she on the night of August 8th, 1969, she had a home up in like Benedict Canyon, which is an area in California kind of near Beverly Hills where a bunch of famous people live, you know. So she was having kind of a small party with some friends over. On that night, Charles Manson had instructed 4 of his followers to go up to their home in Benedict Canyon and basically just brutally murder anyone that they could find there. And again, I don't want to go into details on the killings because I think we could do this on a future episode. But spoiler alert, these people were able to break into the home. They tied up these people and eventually killed them all. And some of them were very, very brutal, especially Sharon Tate. She, who I also will add, was 8.5 months pregnant at the time.
Oh, wow.
Was stabbed 16 times and then hanged. So gruesome, gruesome murder. And there's more than that to the story too, but I just kind of wanted to summarize. We all, like I said, we all kind of know a little bit about the Manson murders. That was one inspiration for this movie. Now this second one actually has a lot more to it. And this is kind of a crazy story too. This is what's going to be the bulk of the episode. So the second inspiration, have you all heard of the Keddie Cabin murders?
No.
You're a true crime aficionado.
Yeah. I don't know where I'd know this story from though.
Well,
is this the Axe murders?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, then I should.
You've come to the right place because I've. This is quite the story. So, the Keddie Cabin murders. This story takes place in April of 1981 in the small town of Keddie, California. K-E-D-D-I-E, Keddie. Sue Sharp, after separating from her husband James, had taken her 5 children, John, Sheila, Tina, Rick, and Greg, and relocated them all from Connecticut, where they lived, to Northern California in the town of Keddie, which is kind of in a very foresty area up in Northern California. They moved into a cabin, house number 28, which was located in a nice forest resort. They'd been living in this house for about a year and were very friendly with all the other neighbors who lived there at the resort. April 11th, the night of the murders, their oldest daughter, Sheila, had gone to sleep over at a friend's house down the street in house number 27. She left around 8 p.m. Younger daughter, Tina, had also been with her sister at the neighbor's house, but she returned back home at around 9:30 p.m. The oldest son, John, and his friend, Dana Wingate, had also just returned home that evening after being out at a party in a nearby town. The two youngest boys, Rick and Greg, were upstairs playing with their friend, Justin Smart. Remember that name for later. So the next morning, April 12th, Sheila comes back home from her neighbors about 8 o'clock in the morning, only to discover the murdered bodies of Sue, John, and his friend Dana in the living room. And these murders were especially violent, with blood being present all over the house. John, this goes into some gory detail, John was found with his hands covered in blood and bound with medical tape, and his throat was slit. Right next to him, his friend Dana was lying on the ground with his head badly damaged as if bashed with a blunt object. His ankles were tied with electrical wire, which also connected to John's ankles, and he had been strangled to death.
I've heard this story.
Is it ringing a bell to you now?
Well, once again, I mentioned this before. This was on an episode of that true crime BuzzFeed that I watch.
It's a pretty grisly story, really.
Yes.
And then Sue, the mother, she had been found naked from the waist down and was gagged with a bandana. Can I backtrack to avoid that loud motorcycle noise?
She was found naked.
Had to be the loudest car in town.
Okay, I'm going to start that sentence over. Sue had been found, let me try that again. Sue, the mother, had been found naked from the waist down and was gagged with a bandana and her own underwear that had been taped together using medical tape. Her throat had also been cut, and I think she had several stab wounds in her chest.
Dang.
A bent steak knife, a bloodied butcher knife, and a claw hammer were all found side by side sitting on a wooden table near the kitchen. And it was determined that all of the victims had suffered stab wounds as well as blunt force trauma from the hammer. So, horribly violent, awful crime scene. This young daughter comes home. I think she was about 14 or 15. Comes home to discover all this from being at the neighbor's house overnight.
Oh my God.
Couldn't even imagine. That's horrific.
Is that what the 911 tape was played from?
The 911 tape?
At the beginning of the movie, they play a 911 tape. It sounded like it was real.
I don't think so.
It's a little girl coming home and finding all these people like murdered.
Inspired, probably, very likely, but I don't think it was the real. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would highly doubt it was a real tape.
Hmm.
The three younger boys, Rick, Greg, and their friend Justin, were somehow found safe in an adjacent room and were quickly removed by the neighbors from house number 27. I think Sheila had gone back and gotten them, and they came over and found the boys and got them out of there. The scene was so grisly and horrifying that it took investigators hours to even realize a fourth victim was missing, which was the younger sister, Tina, the one who had been at the neighbor's house and came home that night. With no trace of Tina, her case was considered an abduction, and at this point the FBI had gotten involved. But the investigation would yield no apparent motive in the killings. There was no sign of forced entry into the cabin, but an unidentified fingerprint was discovered on the railing to the back door. The phone had been left off the hook and all the lights turned off and the drapes closed. The neighbors in house 27 didn't hear any commotion in the night, but apparently a different couple living in a nearby house 16, I'm not sure how all these houses are numbered nearby.
Because they're cabins.
They're cabins, yes.
That's why.
I didn't know if the numbers on cabins go in. Yeah, but like 16
sounds like it's way further away than 27.
I have a little bit of a different view of it because, like I said, I've seen the episode that shows.
Yeah,
them
it's not like a street. It's not like a neighborhood street.
No,
it's
and they're in the woods.
It's too. A resort within the woods. Yeah, so they're kind of cabins that are spread out.
I've actually seen knows what it looks like. I know what it looks like, so I don't know.
The number's really irrelevant for this.
I know
story.
It's really confusing, like to hear it for the first.
They were nearby. They were a nearby house. They had heard this. They had heard a sound that they thought sounded like muffled screaming at around 1 a.m. But apparently, they weren't able to discern much more than that, and
well,
they just went back
to
bed.
Muffled screams. Oh my God, that's a scream!
It was something. You never know till you're in that moment.
God. Yeah, I don't know. If you woke up in the middle of the night and heard muffled screaming, I don't know how much investigating
like
I would do.
Somebody trying to smother a pterodactyl. It didn't get better.
I definitely would not go investigate. I'd probably move. I'd get my
somebody
thing and I'd move
that
night.
Somebody take that pillow off that pterodactyl's beak.
So,
I'm sorry.
So anyway, one neighbor, they didn't hear anything. These neighbors heard something. So how did the three young boys not only survive this massacre untouched, but also, supposedly, were totally unaware anything happened? At first, the three boys...
They were just laying sound asleep.
They were in a next room, had no idea anything happened. Already sound a little fishy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Justin Smart, the friend of the two sharp boys, he later came out and said... Well, he saw Sue with two men that night, and oh shoot, I didn't have an image queued up. He actually kind of they did a sketch, you know those police sketches. Hold on, I'm gonna bring it up real quick because he actually would kind of describe the.
Yeah,
if
he didn't draw his own sketches, I'm not impressed.
Here's the sketch. We'll share this. Here's the two men that he described that formed this police sketch.
Hmm. The guy kind of looks familiar.
You close friends with him?
They're
you've probably seen this.
It really does look
familiar for some reason. BuzzFeed stuff, but yeah.
I've probably just seen this on like one of the investigation discovery shows.
I think it's a pretty famous true crime case because it's actually a cold case too. We're going to get into that, not to spoil the end, but it gets crazier in my opinion. So Justin saw two men with Sue that night. I just showed you guys the sketch. Said one of the men had a hammer. Justin then said that John and Dana came home and got into an argument with the men, which resulted in a violent fight. Tina was then taken out of the back door by one of the men. So at this point, the Sacramento Department of Justice gets involved, and they would send two agents from their organized crime unit down there, and people thought that was weird that they would send people from an organized crime unit and not from a homicide unit. So... Put a pin in that
it's
until
very
later.
Random.
Put a pin in that until later. Soon after that, two lead suspects would emerge. Justin Smart's father, Martin Smart, who was a nearby neighbor, and his friend, ex-convict John Bodaby. I'm not sure how you say his last name. We'll call him Bo. Who was known to have connections with organized crime in the area. This okay. Bo fella. Both Martin and Bo had been seen in suits and ties and behaving oddly in the bar the night before all this happened.
This doesn't bode well for them.
It does not. Martin Smart later told the police that he had a hammer that matched the one discovered, and also that his hammer had gone missing shortly before the murders.
Why would you? Why by would the way, you, I had the same fucking thing that was used to bludgeon these people. Isn't
that
crazy?
Would you look at that, Bo?
What a doesn't big coinkydink.
And wasn't that the I mean, one that the got fuck? Stolen recently? Mm,
same model number and everything.
Right?
Do hammers have model numbers? I'm sure they do.
Everything that comes out of a factory does.
I mean, tell me you did it without telling me you did it.
Like, why the
and
fuck?
And tell me you're trying to cover your tracks without telling me you're trying to cover your tracks. That sounds to me like you're saying, just in case you find it, yeah, I do own one, but it was stolen.
Yeah.
By you the find way, that when, exact yeah, one. When you're done with that, I'm missing a hammer. Can I,
can I have that back?
So, yeah. So, and then later, later that same year,
wait,
a knife.
How did they know it was a hammer? Did the police tell them that?
I guess so. I guess the facts were known at this point that
this
a hammer was
after
found.
After the initial,
this is just during the investigation. Yeah.
The timeline. Coroner's report and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I just imagine this goofy conversation like, oh, well, how did you know it was a hammer? We never said it was a hammer. Well, you never said it wasn't.
Well, you. So stuff I reveal later might kind of.
When the
also
skull is struck with a hammer, it
please don't look at me like that.
Slightly leaves a little bit of an indention on the skull because the impact spreads out around a small surface.
Speaking like a man.
How
who
would
knows.
The guys who didn't murder them, though? That is what I was joking about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, if it was a hammer.
Yeah,
I'm
true.
Not saying it was, but if it was a hammer, we lost one.
Well, you might. It might make sense later too. With some of the stuff I
and
say.
I knew
so.
All that. I've seen Dexter.
Didn't get that from Dexter.
He got it from personal experience. Don't let him fool you.
I did. Don't you remember that was the guy John Lithgow on there? Yeah, the hammer.
Mm-mm.
You don't remember that one?
I probably need. I need to go back and watch.
Oh,
Dexter.
That was the best season.
Oh, with the Trinity Killer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember
yeah.
He used the ball peen hammer or whatever?
No, I don't remember him killing
him.
Oh, you
didn't go back and watch
it. Yeah, it's been a minute.
Sorry, Trent.
No,
were you talking
okay.
about
no,
something?
I'm getting, it's okay. All right, so we know about the hammer. Later that year, a knife was also recovered in a trash can outside of a Keddy General store. Authorities also believe this item to be linked to the crimes. Okay. Fast forward exactly 3 years later. Exactly. 3 years later, April 11th of 1984. Hopefully you haven't forgotten about Portina. Because a bottle collector discovered human remains, specifically a cranium portion of a human skull and part of a jawbone in a campground in a nearby county. And it's like maybe one or two counties over. These remains would indeed be confirmed to be the remains of Tina Sharp. So, 3 years pretty much to the day they find Tina's remains, this becomes a quadruple homicide at this point. She had been missing up until then. So, I said earlier this is a cold case. It still technically would remain a cold case for many years, but there actually have been a lot of new developments that would surface, like within probably the last 10 years, because a new team of investigators took over and kind of reopened the case. And so I'm going to go over some of the things that was either ignored or overlooked during the original initial investigation. So here we go. Back when was Tina found? 1984. So right after her remains were found, apparently there was an anonymous tip that called one of the investigative authorities. I don't have which one here, but there's a tape recording of this.
This is not the father, and if you find a hammer, it does not belong to me.
Well, it was an anonymous tip call. It was undocumented, and the recording of it was found sealed in the bottom of an evidence box. They were just going through all the old evidence, this new team was, and found this tape. And it was a tip from an anonymous caller received right after Tina Sharp's remains were discovered, and the caller was wondering if they had thought of the murder up in Keddy a couple years ago where a 12-year-old girl was never found. This random anonymous caller called asking this question.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. What do you think about those Keddy murders?
Could it be that girl that was murdered?
You didn't
ago?
Hear this from me.
So that was one thing. In 2016, so 2013 was when they uncovered that tape, when they found it. 2016, a hammer, believed to be one of the murder weapons, was discovered in a dried-up pond in Keddy.
Wait a minute.
Here's where it gets really crazy. It was also later came to light that Marilyn Smart, who was the wife of Martin, had just left her husband the day of the murder discovery. She later provided investigators with a handwritten letter sent to her and signed by her ex, which read, "I've paid the price of your love, and now that I've bought it with four people's lives, you tell me we are through? What else do you want?"
Oh, wow.
This letter was not treated as a confession, and even though Marilyn later admitted that she believed her husband and his friend Beau committed the crime, this was contradicted by the sheriff, who said Martin had passed a polygraph test. A polygraph test, which yeah. no one takes for shit these days.
They can't possibly be guilty. He passed the polygraph.
It was later confirmed the sheriff and Martin were actually very close.
What?
Well, the plot thickens.
Surviving daughter Sheila had given an interview back in 2016, and she said that she was told the suspects were told to get out of town, and she believes it to be a cover-up. Also in 2016, investigators had met with a counselor from a Reno, Nevada VA who had, I guess, met with Martin in the year of...
Who supposedly told the suspects to get out of town?
We'll theorize on that in a second.
But they weren't telling them to flee town. They were just saying, get out of town.
Get out of town. Hey.
Get out of town with that hammer bullshit.
Okay. But anyway, there was this anonymous counselor that kind of came forward and told investigators that they were from Reno, Nevada. They had, I guess, met or Martin Smart had come to them. I don't know. May of 1981, Martin Smart had confessed to kill Sue. Or he confessed to the murders of Sue and Tina. He supposedly told the counselor, "I killed the woman and daughter, but didn't have anything to do with the boys." When the Department of Justice was told this back in 1981, they dismissed it as hearsay. Nah, we're not going to look into that any further.
Jesus.
Literally confessing to people, confessed to this counselor, pretty much confessed in his letter to his ex-wife. No one took it seriously.
Get out of town.
The popular theory through all this was that there was a love triangle between Martin, his wife Marilyn, and Sue Sharp. It was believed that Martin and Sue were having an affair and that Sue was supposedly counseling Marilyn to leave her husband, who she had said was abusive to her. When Martin found out about this, he enlisted Beau, his friend and known mob enforcer who had been temporarily living with the Smarts right before the murders, to take Sue out of the picture. This would account for Marilyn leaving her husband the day of the murder. It would also explain why the Smart boy and the other Sharp boys in the next room were spared. Well, yeah, if your dad's the fucking murderer. Additionally, it gives context to Martin's handwritten note that Marilyn gave to investigators. Some investigators who picked up the case when it was reopened back in 2013 tie the slayings into an even larger plot and believe that Beau and Martin fit into a larger drug smuggling scheme that involved the federal government. Starting to wonder why it's getting covered up now. This might explain why the Sacramento Department of Justice sent two allegedly corrupt organized crime agents instead of a homicide agent. It would also provide an explanation as to why the two lead suspects were seemingly given a free pass and told to leave town by the sheriff.
Okay.
Furthermore, it suggests an answer as to why this case was handled so sloppily to begin with, because obviously it was this horribly botched... It was either botched or covered up investigation. And we talk about botched investigations and bad police work all the time on this podcast. And I think this is no different.
It's a common theme in true crime.
And so now at this point, Martin, Smart, and Beau are deceased. New evidence has pointed investigators to other suspects who may have had a hand in these murders, including the disposal of the evidence and the abduction of Tina. And it's believed that there are actually more people that were involved with this, some of who might still be alive today. But that's kind of where it's at right now. So it's still technically unsolved.
Now, you answered my question by saying the sheriff told him to get out of town, but does it ever say why the sheriff told him to get out of town? Because police don't usually tell a murder suspect, you know what you need to do? You need to get out of town.
Because they were friends,
were friends, yeah. And obviously this was a big cover-up if Martin and or Beau were involved in some sort of organized crime or drug smuggling or whatever they were involved with.
Okay.
These are just all theories. Obviously,
sheriff
none
was
of
getting
it's...
greased is what it sounds like to me.
Well, probably. I mean, literally, you had that confession from the VA counselor, hearsay. You had that note where he wrote his ex-wife, and that was, you know, he passed the polygraph test. He's
get out of town.
So obviously, there was some sort of weird corruption going on, and yeah, I mean that. I honestly did not expect to go into so much detail with this case. I just, when I first started reading it, I knew it was just going to be a random kind of unsolved murder of four people in a cabin. I was like, oh, that fits the narrative of the movie a little bit. And I started getting deeper into it. I was like, oh my God, I can't leave all this stuff out.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was a really crazy story. If there's other stuff I may have left out and anyone out there is familiar with the Keddy Cabin murders, please let us know because I thought that was a very interesting true crime case. So
you said this was Keddy's where again?
Keddy's in California, Northern California, up in the very foresty area.
Like a very small town in California?
I think it's a smaller town, yeah. It's like a railroad town is what they described it as.
Okay.
So that brings us to our final little inspiration for the movie, and this one's really a lot quicker. This is probably the biggest inspiration, though, because actually this involves a real-life incident that the director of the film, Brian Bertino, experienced as a child. Bertino recalls one night when his parents were gone, and it was he and his sister home alone. A woman knocked on their door and asked for someone who didn't live there. She was sent away, but she would eventually come back to their home later and ask the same question again. Brian and his sister later found out that other homes in his neighborhood were broken into that night. The woman was a member of the group, which would go around to different houses and knock on doors. If no one was home, they'd break in and rob them. If someone did answer the door, they would ask for a random person pretending to be at the wrong house.
That's creepy.
So that's pretty much the whole setup of the movie right there. And yes, that is very creepy. I could not, like, I wanted to ask you guys if you had any, like, incidents that involved, not necessarily breaking into your house, but like a stranger that creeped you out or, you know, tried to talk to you. You guys have anything?
Maybe not a stranger, but Wells is creeping out plenty of times.
Well, that's what I do, man.
He's not a stranger at this point. But.
No, but seriously, when I was like, I don't know, maybe 12 or 13, and I was at my grandma's house one day, this guy come walking in the front door randomly, just barged right in and...
didn't know him.
No, never seen him before in my life. And he was clearly agitated. He was sweaty. He was dirty. And he said something.
That was me.
No, seriously. He starts going off about, he like focuses on my brother and he's like, you son of a bitch. You told me you were going to help me fix my car and you never did it. And this dude's just like going off at the top of his lungs. And like my brother, like damn near had to put his hands on him. Luckily, my uncle was there who was a police officer at the time.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And
he
handled the situation. It turned out the man was actually an escaped patient from the state hospital.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah. So I've not been a fan of unlocked doors ever since then.
Now, wait a minute. Did your brother ever fix that car? Or?
Nope. Damn. My brother was like, dude, I've never seen you before in my life.
Yeah, that would be freaky. How old were you again?
I was like 12 or 13.
Hmm.
The guy had to walk there. He didn't have his car fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can't personally remember any Which experience house was like this? That.
The house down on West Fifth Street.
Oh, okay. Through the front door there?
Yeah. Oh, just shit. Walked right in.
Got locked in doors, man.
Yeah. That guy, that same guy had wound up getting in some trouble later because he did something to Duke Energy's generators up here on the hilltop one time.
Did he get your brother to help fix them?
No.
You son of a bitch, you were supposed to fix those generators.
But I remember when I was working at the Courier at the time when he did it, and I saw his picture and stuff, and I was like, oh my God, it's that same guy.
Escaped mental patient. You're just like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would...
He's my very own Michael Myers.
Ooh. That is freaky.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't think I can remember anything that's happened like that to me, but it's always been kind of a weird fear of just having someone just randomly show up to your house and just... either, you know, knock at the door late at night or even if they're just like staring at your house from the road or something, kind of like the scene from the movie where she's just kind of standing out there staring. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
So if you guys are in that situation and this woman's knocking on your door and she says she needs help or anything like that, are you going to leave to go help her or what do you think?
Hell no.
So first of all, this is 4 in the morning in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't answering no door at 4 in the morning.
But
and
you guys
I'm
are
certainly
also...
not opening the door. I'm going to go to a side window and peek out and try and get a look first.
But you guys are also the same people who said you would go check on your neighbor who said that she's got...
I said I did not. I think you would go check
on
the neighbor.
Ghost or a demon or whatever.
No, wait a minute. Neighbor.
I said
you
no.
You know the neighbor. You know the neighbor. That's different.
That's true.
I guess it would have to be very, like, if it was someone who was just kind of if it was someone who was like frantically, like you could tell there was something going on, maybe. But if it was just someone being calm and quiet and be like, is so-and-so here?
Couldn't a stranger technically just be a neighbor you haven't met yet?
No. Well, yeah. Well, no. I mean, if you've seen them, you know they live there.
Yeah.
So more than likely, they're not going to do anything crazy, over the top crazy, if they live that close to you, because they got to live next to you.
I think you definitely would have to grab your gun.
Let's take
that
same concept and let's say it's a new neighbor and you know they're a new neighbor, but you don't know this person yet. Would you trust them then?
Not if they came at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Ian says, "How hot are they?
How hot are they?" Let me ask you a question.
How many clothes are they wearing?
Do they need their plumbing fixed?
I was actually watching the. Have you ever heard of a show called Dead Silent?
Dead Silent.
A show?
Yeah. I don't think so. It's a show on Investigation Discovery. It's about these murders that take place out in these like secluded places like that in the middle of the woods or whatever in cabins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a similar story. This woman walks up, knocks on their door. She's like, "Oh, my car's broke down. I just really need some help because I'm way out here. I don't know anybody. There's nobody around." Guy goes down, never comes back. So his brother-in-law goes down to check on him, finds this woman down there. Looks over, he's like, "Where's my brother at, so-and-so?" Looks over in the ditch, his brother's laying over on the ground. Of course, this moment, his brain's like, "What the hell's going on?" Next thing he knows, some other guy comes out and whacks him upside the head with a hammer.
You just can't trust anybody. I mean, you want to be a nice person and trusting, but it's just, the world's too fucked up. I mean, and I think that's why, like, home invasion movies, I don't want to say they're, like, the scariest of the horror movies, but obviously they're very real. Like,
yeah,
any sick bastard could come into your house at night with a weapon or whatever, or lure you out like that. And
that's what I love about movies.
Very realistic.
Like, movies like this, movies like this are my favorite cons as far as horror. Because I love movies like The Conjuring, too. But that's not shit that happens to people every day.
Yeah, it's not stuff that you would expect to.
Home invasions and stranger danger is something that people face every day.
Oh, yeah. And especially ones like the strangers where they just are doing it just to do it because they're evil or whatever. They have no motive, which is kind of like what the, is what they thought the Keddie Cabin murders didn't have a motive. Obviously, I think they did. But yeah, anytime there's something like that where you can't connect to anything either, that just makes it worse because it's like, well, what the fuck? You're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And
yeah, and then that chilling line in the movie puts it all in perspective, which I forgot about this line until I watched it recently for this episode. And she's like, "Well, why are you guys doing this to us?" And that girl just goes, "Because you're home."
Yeah.
Like, wow. The fact that it's not personal makes it even scarier.
More personal.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We could transition into the movie with that. I mean, I feel like we've already kind of discussed it a little bit, but you rewatched it again for this episode. It still hold up pretty well for you.
Absolutely. I love this movie. And I love that it's it's an hour and 25 minutes, so
very easy, brisk watch.
Yeah, when a movie's got that kind of runtime, you know they're going to get right into, as Torrance likes to say, the meat and potatoes of the situation.
That's right.
Yeah, I thought the movie did a really good job of just, like, it was obviously very full of tension, like especially that first 20 or 30 minutes where they're kind of still, like, knocking on the door, you don't know what's going on yet.
Mm-hmm.
But even like building up the characters in the beginning and how they're kind of going through a weird breakup kind of makes the situation even worse because, I mean, obviously it would be scary no matter the situation, but knowing that these people are in like a weird place and like, and then all this other shit happens to them right on top of it, I don't know, it just kind of adds to it for me.
Yeah, it does. Interestingly enough, on Shudder, there's two versions of the same movie. One of them is a 3-minute difference. One of them's 1 hour and 25 minutes. The other version's 1 hour and 28 minutes.
There's like I watched it on DVD, and there was like an extended cut or something, but I don't really know what the differences are off the top of my head. But
Trent, what are the differences off the top of your head?
I don't know.
Fuck.
This was the first time I watched it in probably, I don't know, it's been several years. And I remember the first time thinking it was just kind of okay, and then I actually kind of enjoyed it more this time. I don't know. I don't know what else to really.
I remember loving it from the very first time that I watched it, for pretty much the same reason that the original Scream movie I thought was scary, because like I said when we did that episode a long time ago, even as a kid, I knew that Scream was more scary because I was like, that could be anybody in a mask with a knife going around killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scarier than Freddy or Jason has ever been to me.
I still don't understand in these home invasion type movies how anyone with a knife or an axe still one-ups someone with a gun or a shotgun in this case.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, just fucking...
You shoot him?
Like, what? Did they just abandon the gun after he shot his friend? Was that, like, too traumatic? He couldn't... I mean...
Well, and then another thing, there's one scene where...
he gave
where,
up on the gun after that.
After the strangers are first arriving in the house, the husband goes to the... or she gets back with the husband, catches up with him, and they're in that room. And then he grabs, like, the butcher knife, and he's going to go out and investigate. And she's like, please don't go out there.
Yeah, why?
He's like, just stop. I got this. I'm like, why? Just stay put.
And then why did she go out in the backyard and then immediately fall in a fucking hole? Barefoot, by the way. I don't think she had shoes on. Like, I know the guy was behind her and creeping up on her, but I don't know that she realized that, did she?
I'm sorry, Trent, but she's a white chick in a scary movie. She has to fall.
You're lucky your blouse didn't fly off.
That's right.
Am I? I call that
unlucky. That's not luck.
But yeah, I don't know. Maybe she thought he was back there. Maybe she saw him. I don't know. But she just took off in the backyard for no reason and bare feet and then immediately fell in a hole. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Why is anyone leaving this house? You have a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
I know you just shot your friend in the face. That sucks. But you still got those three fuckers to worry about outside.
That's what I'm saying.
You.
You're in a secluded cabin like that. There should be like several guns in the house, really. Once we're in that room together, I'm in here, my wife's in here, I know we're together.
Ex-girlfriend.
We're going to keep that door safe.
Yeah.
And shut.
Like,
and
I realize he's never really...
Whatever comes to that door, we'll deal with that when it happens.
I realize he wasn't a very gun-savvy person, and he didn't really know how to use it, but, like, once you get it figured out and it's loaded, just not much to it after that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I say that, and then I'd probably be like, I'd probably freeze or something. Someone was in my house, and even if I had a gun.
You might, but that's why you have to run what-if scenarios, so you're a little bit mentally prepared for these situations at least.
Secluded cabin in the woods, that's just like basic stuff. You got to have a plan.
But it's also different like when you're in that situation, the adrenaline starts pumping, and then the anxiety kicks in.
True.
Like, oh, God.
Plus, I guess you don't know that they don't have a gun or anything. Like, you don't know what they got.
So it's exactly. Like a lot of people in the army are trained, but like sometimes like when shit gets... like goes down, like you hear of like them abandoning their posts and stuff.
True. Or trained police officers overreacting and shooting people who they shouldn't be shooting.
They would never do that, Wells.
Yeah.
Never. But yeah, perfect example.
I like to believe that I would do what's necessary in that situation, especially if I was responsible for another life.
Mm-hmm.
But you just never know.
Why'd you point to me?
Protect you.
Aw.
If we were in a secluded cabin together, alone.
Yeah.
For reasons not to be disclosed.
I know where you're saying if, not when. But.
And we were stalked by three weirdos and we had a gun.
We'd invite them in.
I'd sit there
but
and
you guys,
you,
you guys are right. You could sit here and be like, you'd do this or that or whatever.
Yeah,
and you don't know
to say that.
When
you
your adrenaline's
know.
Pumping. But that is what if scenarios are for, in the hopes that you can train your brain at least enough to, even if you are in that situation and your adrenaline's pumping, you can at least calm down enough like, okay, I've gone through this. What
Wells,
should we do? What do we
I
need
can't
to
even
do?
Train my
to
brain
fair,
to make a decision when I'm trying to pick Froyo out. So.
And to be fair, he
You'll
did
get, there.
He did get the shot off. He delivered. It just happened to be his best friend. Blown half his face
Nailed
off.
It.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Is there anything else about this movie you want to chime in on? What do you remember?
No.
The biggest part I remember is her being out there like on the swings and then her coming in and her being like, I'm sorry, that was Nancy Kerrigan. She's like, what did she say? Like, why are you doing this? And she's like, because you were home. That's the big part I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't remember how like chilling that line is until I watched it recently.
I didn't remember the
Her
ending.
Delivery was really creepy on it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were home.
The very ending I didn't remember and kind of surprised me. I was like,
fuck.
When Liv
with the kids?
Tyler woke up and grabbed that kid at the end.
Oh, that
was
creepy
lives.
As shit. Yeah, I didn't remember that either.
She's
Maybe
alive.
That was the extended version.
No, I watched the shorter one.
Oh.
The whole
the
three
extra
shorter.
Minutes, she actually stabs the kids.
Oh, my God.
I'd see what that
takes
is.
Takes their bikes and goes.
Maybe there's like a end credit scene or something.
I'll go back and watch it.
That leads
it
into
sure you watched the director's cut?
I am very curious to watch Parade Night now because I remember when it came out. I don't know, when was that? It's been several years now, but I wasn't super like into watching it because again, I remembered the first one being just okay. But again, now after watching, I'm like, okay, it's a little better than I remember. Now I'd be curious to watch Parade at Night, especially now that I hear that it's actually not too bad. And then this new trilogy coming out, I'm kind of excited for. So maybe
because even in the version that I watched, the hour and 25 minute one, they like kind of set up the sequel at the end with the kids. When she gets out and she gets one of the pamphlets from them, and then she gets back in the truck and she says, it'll be easier next time.
Yeah. I definitely feel like it's going to be the same killers that just kind of go from town to town maybe and prey at night on people.
Are you talking about the new trilogy there?
Or even in the sequel. I don't know if the new trilogy is going to deal with the same killers or not. It just kind of looked like it from the little poster I saw that they had the same masks on. It could be copycats, like you said, just wearing... I mean, we'd never know because we don't even know who the original people were.
Yeah, we never get to see their face. Unless you're just that good to be like, hey, that's not the same voice.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, let's go around and rate it and we could wrap this episode up. Starting with Wells. Unless you don't want to.
I'm going to give it a... how long ago did this movie come out? Do you remember?
That don't matter.
I'm just asking.
I think 2008.
It's 2007.
Was it really that long ago?
Actually, it might have been 2008. It was either 2007 or 2008. Trent's about to tell us.
I had my notes. Well, 2008.
Anyway, I just wanted to say that, like, I feel like this movie's... stands alone very well on its own. It doesn't suffer from, we've talked about a lot of those 2000s movies just have that weird 2000s feel to them. This one feels like it could have just came out to me.
Yeah, it definitely didn't have any sort of like trademarks at the time. Like it was very, it seemed kind of low budget too because it was a lot of handheld camera work and not really any effects to speak of. So just a lot of just tension and good direction.
And before I do rate it, I just want to say that at the end when they have them, the couple tied up in the chairs, I love the way they did that too because they don't really like show a whole lot of the violence, but you hear shit and it leaves it all up to your imagination.
Yeah.
It's just like the way Liv Tyler screaming and shit is just
not Liv.
Chilling.
Not Arwen.
I want to give it a solid 7.5. I think that's fair.
I was going to come in at a 6.5, which sounds low, but still respectable.
It's so funny you said that. I was going to give it a 6.5 from what I remember.
That makes more sense because you said when you first watched it, you thought it was just all right, whereas I first watched it, I loved it the first time. So, and I still love it the same.
Yeah. Solid. Solid.
I didn't watch it recently like these guys.
Shame.
But I've seen it before.
You're no stranger to this movie.
I'm no strangers, and I don't pray at night.
Fun fact, just this past October, 2023, I had my little annual Halloween movie marathon, and I had The Strangers in there, and I had Gnawbone in there, too.
Appreciate you.
That's right.
God, I'm sorry to hear that. Am I right? Trent, am I right?
That's the movie I helped make.
Are you sure?
Gnawbone.
What am I thinking? Wishbone?
That's right, you son of a bitch.
Wishbone is the dog with the circle around his eye. He went on adventures.
Yeah,
he
told get it right, man.
What's
get
the story, Wishbone? I was close.
This is a tight little episode.
Hambone, maybe? Was that the...
Is it, what's going on about over there? You and your bones. Try to wrap this up.
So you two are settling on 6.5?
Yeah, I think so. That's not bad.
It's not bad.
Was 6.5.
I feel like you got it for me to hit that threshold of 7. It's really got to have that extra something to it. I don't know. Can't explain it. My ratings are my ratings. They're weird. They make
Torrance,
sense
have you
mind.
Only watched it the one time?
I think I've seen it twice in my lifetime.
Okay.
But 6.5 is very still respectable to me.
Yeah, it is.
I know it's no 7.5.
Yeah.
But anyway, better than I remember. And the stories to go along with it were all creepy. Keddie Cabin murders, obviously the Manson murders. Hopefully we'll talk about that more in depth in a future episode. So yeah. Well, I hope no one preys on any of us at night. I hope no one gets visited by any creepy strangers.
You probably should pray for us at night though.
Pray for this podcast. We're barely hanging on. Pray for Means wherever he's out doing right now. Maybe he's being A stranger.
I thought you were going to say preyed on, but...
Yeah, it means thank you for not answering your phone, by the way. It's a good thing we didn't need anything important.
Yeah, jerk!
Oh. 5 missed calls from me. Is that...
I'm just kidding. Darren, I'm so sorry.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up, guys. Thanks for tuning in. I don't know why I almost tomahawk chopped you.
I don't know what you're doing over there, man.
Stay tuned. Our big anniversary, not anniversary, our big milestone, 100th episode is coming up pretty soon.
And I've got something real special for y'all.
Oh, real special.
It's going to be real nice.
Mm-hmm. We're going to try and do some fun stuff. We don't have it all planned out yet, but it'll be a cool episode.
On what?
I don't want you to oversell it, just in case it's not that special.
Wow. Our number one fan over here just throwing us under the bus.
We don't want to hear lame ass stories.
To be honest, folks, you should be excited for the 100th episode because I've heard just a little bit about what the story's going to be about, and I'm very excited to hear the rest of it.
And if for nothing else, just be excited that we made it to 100 damn episodes. Who would have thought that? Sure, I know there's still a few of you out there listening.
The way Ian's coughing over there, I don't know if he will make it to 100 episodes.
True. I know, right? By the time the 100th episode comes
out. Yeah, got to quit smoking them menthols, buddy.
That's what it is. I'm a heavy smoker.
Yeah. Get those vapes over there.
For the Horror You Know podcast.
That's fair. I have vaped recently.
I have been Trent.
I'm still Ian.
I will forever and always be the dead of Ian. Night,
and we're not strangers. We're your friends from the Horror You Know podcast.
What?
I've been Trent. Are we doing it again?
No. I don't know what's happening at this point. I think at this point.
Now is the time to let the Horror You Know.